Jack nodded. Chastened. I know. I'll work on it, I promise. And now, in the locker room at Case Western Reserve, Jack worked on it. He tried out his happy face on the empty room, while thinking back to that poor woman's family, unable to find work in an environment that stifled the entire industry in which she sought employment. Chin up, a slight nod, eyes relaxed, no squinting. Ugh, Jack thought. Feels unnatural. He sighed. He realized, not for the first time, that if it feels unnatural, then that means Kathy was right, and he had been making faces ever since he'd thrown his hat into the ring. He worried now that debating foreign policy in person with Ed Kielty would be a tremendous challenge to his self-control. Jack spent one more moment practicing the happy face, thought about Kathy watching this debate from the audience. He smiled unnaturally at the mirror. Did it again. A third time. The fourth smile on his lips was real. He almost laughed. He couldn't help it. A grown man making faces into a mirror. He snorted out a laugh now. Politics, when you drilled right down into it, was ultimately so goddamn ridiculous. Jack Ryan Sr. shook his head and stepped to the door. One more long sigh. One more affirmation to himself that he could pull off the happy face. And then he turned the knob. Outside in the hall, his people began moving. Andrea Price O'Day stepped up to his shoulder. The rest of his security team formed in a diamond around him for the walk to the stage. Swordsman is moving, Price O'Day said into her cuff mic. 19. Ed Kielty and Jack Ryan stepped out from opposite wings onto a stage awash in television lighting. There was polite applause from a crowd of students, media, and Clevelanders who'd managed to secure tickets. They met in the middle. Jack had a quick mental image of the men touching gloves, but instead they just shook hands. Ryan smiled and nodded, said, Mr. President, and Kielty himself nodded, reached behind Ryan, and patted him on the back with his right hand as both men stepped forward to the round table. Ryan knew that Ed Kielty wished he had a switchblade in that hand. The two men sat at the small conference table. In front of them sat CBS Evening News anchor Joshua Ramirez, a young-looking 50-year-old who wore his hair slicked back and stylish glasses that, with the glare of the stage lighting, created a distracting shine in Ryan's eyes. Jack liked Ramirez overall. He was smart and affable enough when the camera was off, and professional enough when the camera was on. CBS had been no friend to Ryan's first presidency, and they certainly seemed to be continuing the pro-Kielty slant through this campaign. But Josh Ramirez was just a foot soldier in their army, a working stiff, and Ryan didn't blame him. Ryan had been kicked around in the media long enough not to take it personally. Some of the things the media said and wrote about him, virtually accusing him of everything from stealing money from the elderly to taking lunches from school kids' mouths, were nothing if not incredibly personal. Jack Ryan, you are a vile human being. Nothing personal.
Right.
Still, Ramirez wasn't as bad as some of the others. The general media's collusion in Kielty's re-election campaign was prevalent. A few weeks back, a guy at a Kielty Q&A in Denver had the temerity to ask the President of the United States when he thought gas prices would drop back down to where he could afford a road trip with his family. Kielty, in a moment that must have made his minders groan, shook his head at the question from the working stiff and suggested that the man see this as an opportunity to go out and buy a hybrid vehicle. Not one of the major media outlets or wire services ran the quote. Ryan himself brought it up the next morning at an electric motor plant in Allegheny, Pennsylvania, making the obvious point, seemingly lost on Kielty, that a family having trouble filling their tank might have trouble purchasing a new car. 5 minutes after making the quip, as Jack climbed back into his SUV to leave the motor plant, Arnie Van Dam just shook his head.
Jack, you just delivered a great line that no one but those people on that factory floor will ever hear.
Arnie was right. None of the big media outlets ran it. Van Dam promised Ryan he could not count on any gotcha moments by the mainstream media against Ed Kielty. No, all the gotcha moments would go against Jack Ryan. Liberal bias in the media was a fact of nature. Like the rain and the cold, Ryan just dealt with it and moved on. Ramirez opened the debate with an explanation about the rules, then a lighthearted story about arguments between his elementary school children, finishing by joking that he hoped the two men in front of him would play nice.
Ryan smiled as if the comment was not outrageously patronizing, and then the moderator began with the questions. Ramirez's line of questions started out in Russia, moved to China, to Central America, and then to the United States' relationships with NATO and allies around the world. Both Ryan and Keelty addressed the CBS anchor directly with their answers, and they avoided any fireworks, even agreeing on a few topics here and there. International terrorism was all but avoided until the second half of the 90-minute debate. Ramirez turned to the subject by lobbing a softball to Keelty, a question about a recent drone hit on a compound in Yemen that had taken out an Al-Qaeda operative wanted for bombing a nightclub in Bali. Keelty assured America that once reelected, he would continue his carrot-and-stick policy of high-level engagement with anyone, friend or foe, who would come to the negotiating table with America, while at the same time eliminating America's enemies when they refused to negotiate. Ramirez turned to Ryan.
Your campaign has attempted to position you as the candidate who is the best choice in America's fight against those who would do us harm. But when you were president, there were fewer successful targeted killings of high-level terrorists than under President Keelty's first term. Are you willing to accept that you no longer can lay claim to the title of terrorist hunter?
Ryan took a sip of water. To his left, he could sense Keelty leaning in slightly, as if to make a show of listening to how Ryan would answer this one. Jack kept his attention on Joshua Ramirez as he spoke.
I would like to suggest that President Keelty's drone attacks, while unquestionably taking some of the terrorist leadership off the table, do little to fight a successful war in the long-term sense.
Keelty leaned back in his chair, waving the comment away as if it were preposterous.
And why is that? Ramirez asked. Because if I've learned one thing in my 35 years of public service, it is that good intelligence is the key to good decision-making. And when we go to the trouble to identify someone, some terrorist leader who has an absolute treasure trove of intelligence resources in his head, only as a last resort should we be blowing him to pieces. An unmanned aerial vehicle is an important asset, but it is only one asset. It is only one tool, and it is a tool, in my opinion, that we are overusing. We need to exploit the hard work that has been done by our military and intelligence people in identifying the target in the first place, and we need to do our best to exploit the target.
Exploit it? Ramirez asked. He really did not expect Ryan to question the uptick in UAV assassinations.
Yes. Exploit. Instead of killing the man we're after, we need to try to learn what he knows, who he knows, where he's been, where he's headed, what he's planning, those sorts of things.
And how will President Jack Ryan do that?
Our intelligence community and military should be allowed to, when possible, detain these people, or we should pressure the governments hosting these people to pick these men up in the field and turn them over to us. We need to give our forces and the forces of our allies, our true allies, the resources and the political cover to do this. That is not happening under President Ed Keelty.
And once we have them?
For the first time in tonight's debate, Keelty blurted in, directing his comment toward Ryan.
What do you suggest? Bamboo shoots up the fingernails?
Joshua Ramirez lifted a finger off the desk in an extremely gentle wag, a feeble and ineffective means of admonishing Keelty to play by the agreed-upon rules of the debate. Jack ignored Keelty himself, but addressed the question.
Many people say we cannot derive intelligence from means other than torture. My experience knows that to be untrue. Sometimes it is difficult to encourage our enemies to be forthcoming. They are not only highly motivated, but they are also very well aware that we will extend them privileges and rights they would never extend to any prisoner they hold. It doesn't matter how kindly and gently we handle their prisoners. They will kill and torture our people whenever they get them.
The CBS anchor said, "You speak about these means that we have at our disposal to coax information from our enemies, but just how effective are they?"
A very fair question, Josh. I can't go into the procedures that were in place when I was at CIA or when I was president, but I promise you that our success rate getting intelligence from terrorists was much better than my opponent's tactic of blowing up people from an altitude of 20,000 feet. Dead men tell no tales, as they say.
Ramirez turned halfway to Keelty before the president began his rebuttal.
Josh, my opponent would risk American lives unnecessarily by sending our kids in the military into harm's way in the most dangerous places in the world just for the chance to interrogate an enemy combatant. I assure you,
Interrogations under a Jack Ryan presidency will be beyond what is allowed in the Geneva Conventions. It was Ryan's turn to rebut. He forgot his happy face, but he took care not to look at Keelty, instead keeping his focus on the annoying reflections in the glasses of Joshua Ramirez.
First, I consider our fighting men and women to be just that, men and women. Many of them are young, a heck of a lot younger than President Keelty and I, but I bristle at the description of them as kids. Second, the men and women who work in those elite units of the military and intelligence communities who are tasked with the admittedly difficult and dangerous job of capturing our enemies in the field are professionals, and they go into harm's way with regularity already. Often for the policies of my opponent, which, I believe, aren't getting us anywhere. Now he looked to Keelty with a polite nod. You are absolutely right about that, Mr. President, that it is a very, very difficult duty to give anyone, then back to Ramirez. But these men and women are the best in the world at this type of work. And to the last man and the last woman, I truly believe that they know that their hard work saves American lives. They understand their duty, a duty they volunteer for, and a duty that they believe in. I have nothing but the most tremendous respect for our UAV crews. He paused. I'm sorry, unmanned aerial vehicles. It is an incredible resource operated by incredible people. I just feel that at the strategic level, we should be doing a better job directing our assets to exploit our intelligence successes to the highest possible degree. And I do not believe we are doing that under Ed Keelty's administration.
Ramirez started to say something else, but Ryan continued.
Joshua, your network reported just the other day about the capture in Russia of the leader of one of the most deadly rebel groups in the Caucasus region by Russia's FSB. Now, I will surprise no one in your audience tonight when I say I am not a huge fan of a lot of Russia's recent decisions and policies.
Ryan smiled when he said this, but his face was no less intense when he was smiling.
Especially when it comes to some of their reported treatment of their own people in the Caucasus. But by capturing this man, Isropil Nabayev, instead of just killing him, they can potentially learn so much about his organization. This can be a game changer in the region.
Jack Ryan paused, shrugged.
We could use a game changer or two in the Middle East, I think we can all admit that.
Many in the crowd clapped. Ramirez turned back to Keelty.
30 seconds rebuttal on this topic, Mr. President, and then we will need to move on.
Ed Keelty nodded, leaned back in his chair.
Here is something you don't hear too much, Josh. I actually agree with my opponent. We do need, as he put it, a game changer over there. I did not plan on revealing this tonight, but I just got the okay to do so from the Department of Justice. I am going to take this opportunity to announce the recent capture by U.S. federal law enforcement agencies working with my administration of Mr. Saif Rahman Yassin, better known as the Emir.
Keelty waited for the gasps in the audience to subside. They did, eventually, and then he continued.
Yassin has killed dozens of Americans here at home, and he has killed hundreds of Americans and others around the world. He is now on U.S. soil, in U.S. custody, and I believe we will have a photograph made available to confirm this in the coming hours. I apologize for not bringing this to light before now, but, as you can imagine, there are a lot of security concerns involved, a lot of things to consider. So we have waited to...
30 seconds was up, but Ed Keelty was just getting started.
Bring this to the attention of the public. Now, Josh, I won't be able to comment on any of the details of Yassin's capture or his detainment or his whereabouts. This is all to keep the brave men and women involved in our operation safe. But I will say that I have spoken with the Attorney General at length about the case, and we plan to bring Mr. Yassin to trial just as soon as is feasible. He will be indicted for the incidents he has been tied to here in the United States, in Colorado, in Utah, in Iowa, and in Virginia. Attorney General Brannigan will determine where the trial will take place, but clearly it will be in one of these locations.
Jack Ryan did not lose his cool. He even smiled slightly, nodded pleasantly. Happy face, Jack, he said to himself over and over. He knew this day would come. He knew the Emir was in custody. At first he thought his capture had been kept secret for security reasons, as Ed Keelty just now claimed. But Arnie Van Dam had insisted from the beginning that Keelty was keeping the Emir on ice until he could play him for full advantage in the campaign. At the time, many months earlier, before the Ryan-Kielty battle had even begun in earnest, Jack did not believe his campaign manager. He thought Arnie was just being even more cynical than usual. But not anymore. Van Dam had point-blank predicted that Ed Kielty would dump the Emir out onto the table during one of the debates. He even said it would be number two or number three. Jack wanted to turn his head right now and make eye contact with Van Dam, and it took every bit of willpower to keep from doing so. But he knew that look would be capitalized on by the media outlets in Kielty's corner. The front page of the New York Times tomorrow would read, "Ryan looks for cover." Unless they'd already used that headline once before, it was so hard to remember. So Ryan sat there. He'd turned toward President Kielty as if Jack were hearing this for the first time. He'd groaned inwardly at the claim that Ed's administration had had anything whatsoever to do with the capture of the most wanted man in the world. Ryan had no doubt that the off-handed inference Kielty had made was on purpose. Ryan concentrated on his poker face while he thought about the capture of the Emir. What was it now? 10 months since the campus had taken him down in Nevada? What role his son played in Yassin's capture, Ryan had no idea. Surely he was not in on the ground operation. No, that would have been Chavez. Clark, certainly. Even Jack's nephew, Dominic. Jesus, the poor kid had to deal with all that just after the death of his own brother. But Jack Sr. could not get his head around the fact that his son was involved in the capture of the Emir. True, his oldest boy was changing. Had changed. He'd grown into a man. That was to be expected, even though Jack Sr. did not like it one bit. But his role in the events of the capture of...
"Anything you would like to say to follow up, Mr. President?"
Ryan snapped out of it, chastised himself for letting his mind wander at just the wrong time. Jack caught a sly smile on Josh Ramirez's face, but he knew the cameras had missed it. Every camera in the building was on Ryan. Hell, there was probably a shot halfway up his sinuses, they were so tightly focused on him right now. He wondered if he had a deer-in-the-headlights look. The media would accuse him of it. This would be one hell of a gotcha moment, unless he turned it around right now. Happy face, Jack.
"Well, this is certainly fantastic news. I would like to take this opportunity to extend my sincere and profound congratulations."
Ed Kielty sat up straighter in his chair next to Ryan.
"To the great men and women of our military, intelligence, and law enforcement organizations. And I would also like to thank any foreign nation or service involved in bringing this terrible human being to justice."
Kielty glowered at Ryan now. Jack could see it in Ramirez's glasses.
"This is a great day in America, but I also see this as an important crossroads for us. Because, as you all just heard, President Kielty and his administration plan to try the Emir in our federal court system. And I could not possibly disagree with this any more strongly. As much respect as I have for our system of laws, I think they should be reserved for our citizens and for those who have not made it their life's work to make war on the United States of America. Putting Yassin on the witness stand is not justice. It would be the highest order of injustice. This moment is a fork in the road in our war on terrorism. If President Kielty wins the election in November, for the next couple of years, the Umayyad Revolutionary Council, all its supporters, and its affiliated organizations will have the opportunity to own the bully pulpit. The Emir will use the courts to promote his brand of hate. He will use the courts to reveal the sources and methods of our intelligence services. And he will use the courts to create theater that will only draw attention to him and his cause. And you all, ladies and gentlemen taxpayers, you all will be footing the bill for millions or tens of millions of dollars of increased security in our federal courtrooms. If you think that is a good idea, if you think giving the Emir this opportunity is the right call, well, then I'm sorry to say this, but you'd better go ahead and vote for my opponent. But if you think that is a bad idea, if you think the Emir should get his day in court, but in a military court, where he will have more rights than any prisoner he or those like him ever had in their custody, but still not the same set of rights of every law-abiding, tax-paying American citizen, then I hope you will vote for me.
Ryan shrugged slightly, looked right at Josh Ramirez.
"Josh, I don't make many campaign promises. I get kicked around in a lot of newspapers and the news shows, including yours, for the fact I campaign on my record and on my character, but not on what I promise to do at some later date."
Ryan smiled. I just think most Americans are pretty smart, and they've seen enough campaign promises never come to fruition. It has always been my thinking that if I just show America who I am, what I stand for and believe in, and if I can show myself to be a guy that you can trust, then I'll get some folks to vote for me. If it is enough to win, great. But if it's not, well, America will pick who it thinks is best, and I'm okay with that. But I am going to make a campaign promise right here and now. He turned to the camera. If you see fit to put me in the White House, the first thing I'll do, literally, the first thing I do when I get back to 1600 Pennsylvania from the Capitol steps, is sit down at my desk and sign papers remanding Saif Yassin into military custody. He sighed. You will never see his face on television, or hear his voice on the radio, nor the voice of his attorney. His trial will be fair. He will have a robust defense. But it will be behind a wall. Some people may not agree with that. But I have 6 weeks before Election Day, and I hope you will extend me the courtesy of trying to convince you that this is the right move for the United States of America. Many in the crowd applauded. Many did not. The debate ended soon after. Keelty and Ryan shook hands for the cameras. Then they kissed their wives at the front of the stage. Jack leaned into Kathy's ear. How did I do? Dr. Kathy Ryan kept a wide smile on her face as she whispered back. I'm proud of you. You kept your happy face through all that. She kissed him again and then said with a grin, I do love it when you listen to me. 20. Newport, Rhode Island sits on the southern tip of Aquidneck Island, some 30 miles south of Providence. As well as being the home of Naval Station Newport and more surviving colonial buildings than any other city in the United States, it also retains a number of gargantuan 19th and early 20th century mansions built by many of America's wealthiest industrial and financial tycoons of that time period. John Jacob Astor IV, William and Cornelius Vanderbilt, Oliver Belmont, and Peter Widener of U.S. Steel and American Tobacco, as well as others, all constructed palatial summer retreats on the Tony Island during the Gilded Age of the post-Reconstruction period. Most of the billionaires are gone, their homes now owned by trusts or by family estates or by museums or foundations, but a few uber-affluent individuals still called Newport home. And the most well-heeled resident on the island lived in a massive seaside estate on Bellevue Avenue, just 3 blocks from St. Mary's Cathedral, historically important as the location of the 1953 wedding of John F. Kennedy and Jacqueline Bouvier. This homeowner's name was Paul Laska. He was 70 years old. He was currently number 4 on the Forbes list of wealthiest Americans, and he was of the opinion that a second presidential term of John Patrick Ryan would probably mean, within a couple of years, the end of the world. Sitting alone in the library of his opulent mansion, Paul Laska watched Jack Ryan kiss his wife at the end of the debate. Then Laska stood, turned off the television, and walked alone to his bedroom. His pale, aged face flushed red with anger, and his slumped shoulders reflected his sour mood. He had hoped tonight's debate would be the moment when Ed Keelty's fortunes turned. Laska had hoped this, had all but expected this, because he knew something almost no one else in the world knew until 30 minutes ago. The aging billionaire already knew that the emir was in U.S. custody. This nugget of information had kept his spirits up while Ryan's lead in the polls remained through the summer and into the early fall. He told himself that when Ed made the big reveal in the second presidential debate, he would put to bed that tired adage about Jack Ryan that said he was the tough-on-terror candidate. Then, with a few weeks of heavy campaigning in key battleground states, Keelty would shoot ahead for the home stretch. Now, as Laska took off his slippers and climbed into bed, he realized that his hopes had been fanciful. Somehow, Jack Ryan had still won the damn debate, even with the rabbit Keelty had pulled out of his hat. Hovno, he shouted at the cold, dark house. It meant shit in Czech, and Paul Laska always fell back on his native tongue when cursing. Paul Laska was born Pavel Laska in Brno, in the present-day Czech Republic. He grew up behind the Iron Curtain, but he'd not suffered particularly for this misfortune. His father had been a party member in good standing, which allowed young Pavel to go to good schools in Brno, and then Prague, and then to university in Budapest, and then Moscow. After obtaining advanced degrees in mathematics,
He returned to Czechoslovakia to follow his father into banking. A good communist, Laska had done well for himself in the Soviet satellite nation. But in 1968, he came out in support of the liberal reforms of First Party Secretary Alexander Dubček. For a few short months in 1968, Laska and other Dubček supporters felt the reforms of the Czechoslovakian decentralization from Moscow. They were still communists, but nationalized communists. Their plan was to break away from the Soviets and apply Czech solutions to Czech problems. The Soviets didn't like that plan, needless to say, and KGB operatives flooded into Prague to break up the party. Pavel Laska and a radical girlfriend were picked up with a dozen others at a protest and held for questioning by the KGB. Both were beaten. The girlfriend was sent to prison. But somehow Laska returned to work with the leadership of the uprising, and he stayed with him until one night in August, when Warsaw-packed tanks rolled into Prague, and the fledgling rebellion was crushed on orders from Moscow. Unlike most of the leadership, Laska was not killed or imprisoned. He returned to his bank, but soon emigrated to the United States, taking with him, as he'd told the story thousands of times, only the clothes on his back and a dream. And by most anyone's standards, his dream had been realized. He moved to New York in 1969 to attend NYU. Upon graduation, he went into banking and finance. First, he had a few good years. Then he had a few great years, and by the early 80s, he was one of the wealthiest men on Wall Street. Though he bought properties including his homes in Rhode Island, Los Angeles, Aspen, and Manhattan, in the 1980s, he and his wife used much of their money on their philanthropy, throwing their huge financial resources behind reformers in Eastern Europe in an attempt to enact the changes that had failed to materialize during the Prague Spring. After the fall of world communism, Paul started the Progressive Nations Institute to assist grassroots change in oppressed countries around the world, and he funded development projects across the globe, from clean water initiatives in Central America to landmine eradication efforts in Laos. In the late 1990s, Laska turned his sights inward, toward his adopted nation. He'd long felt the America of the post-Cold War period to be no better than the Soviet Union of the Cold War days. To him, the United States was an oppressive brute in world affairs, and a bastion of racism and bigotry. Now that the Soviet Union was no more, he poured billions of dollars into causes to fight American evils as he perceived them, and, along with spending enough effort engaging in the capitalistic shrine known as the New York Stock Exchange to benefit himself, Laska spent the rest of his time and money supporting the enemies of capitalism. In 2000, he formed the Progressive Constitution Initiative, a liberal political action organization and law firm, and he staffed it with the best and the brightest radical lawyers from the ACLU, academia, and private practice. As well as taking on states and municipalities, the main function of the organization was to sue the U.S. government for what it considered to be overreaches of power. It also defended those prosecuted by the United States and worked against any and all state or federal capital punishment cases, as well as many other causes celeb. Since the death of his wife 7 years before, Laska had lived alone, save for a team of servants and a security detail. But his homes were rarely lonely places. He threw lavish parties attended by liberal politicians, activists, artists, and foreign movers and shakers. The Progressive Nations Institute was run out of Midtown Manhattan, and the Progressive Constitution Initiative out of D.C. But ground zero for the overarching belief system of Paul Laska was his home in Newport. It was no joke when people claimed that more progressive punditry had been doled out on Paul Laska's pool deck than in most liberal think tanks. But his influence did not stop at his organizations or his garden parties. His foundation also financed many left-wing websites and media outlets, and even a confidential online clearinghouse for liberal journalists to gather and pass on story ideas and agree on a cohesive progressive message. Paul funded, sometimes covertly, sometimes not, many radio and television networks across the country, always with a quid pro quo that he and his causes would be given positive press. More than once, an organization had had its financial spigot shut off, either temporarily or permanently, because its reporting did not match the political beliefs of the man who financed the entire operation from behind the scenes. He had contributed to the campaigns of Ed Kielty for 15 years, and many political junkies gave Paul Laska much of the credit for Kielty's success. In interviews, Paul shrugged at these claims, but in private, he fumed. He did not deserve much of the credit for Kielty's success. No, he felt he deserved all of the credit. Laska thought Kielty to be a blow-dried dolt, but a dolt with the right ideas and just enough of the right connections. So Laska had thrown his extensive support behind the man years earlier. It would be unfair to sum up the political beliefs of the billionaire immigrant into one headline, but the New York Post had done so recently after Alaska's speech at a Kielty fundraiser. In typical Post fashion, they filled the inches above the fold with, "Laska to Ryan, you suck." Just hours after the paper came off the presses, Ryan was photographed mugging for the cameras, smiling and holding the newspaper in a Dewey defeats Truman pose. Laska, not to be outdone, was also shown holding the paper. But in typical humorless Laska style, he was not smiling. He held it up for the camera, his eyes framed by square glasses on a square head, and he stared expressionless at the lens. Needless to say, this picture did not convey the light-hearted moment that Ryan's photo did. It was true. Laska hated Jack Ryan. There was no other way to describe the feelings he had for the man. To Laska, Ryan was the perfect embodiment of everything evil and wrong with America. A former military officer. A former head of the dreaded CIA. A former operative himself whose evil deeds around the world had been swept under the rug and replaced with a legend that made him appear to the fools in flyover country like some sort of rugged and handsome paladin. To Laska's way of thinking, Ryan was an evil man who had stumbled into incredible fortune. The plane crash at the Capitol, just as he was awarded the vice presidency, was evidence of a cruel god as far as Laska was concerned. Paul had suffered through the first Ryan presidency, and he'd supported Ed Kielty in his campaign against Ryan's underling, Robbie Jackson. When Jackson had all but sewn up the victory and was assassinated, leaving Kielty to win the election by default, Laska began to have hope for God after all, though he never said such a thing anywhere other than on his pool deck. Kielty had not been the savior the progressives had hoped he would be. Yes, he'd had some wins in Congress on issues dear to the hearts of those on the left, but on Laska's main concern, the American government's projection of power both at home and around the world, Kielty had proven to be not much better than his predecessor. He'd launched more missiles against countries with whom America was not at war than any president in history, and he'd made only cosmetic changes to federal laws against habeas corpus, illegal searches and seizures, wiretapping, and other issues Paul Laska cared about. No, the Czech American was not satisfied with Ed Kielty, but he was a damn sight better than any Republican who would run against him, so Laska had begun investing heavily in Kielty's re-election as soon as he took office. And this investment had been in danger ever since Ryan had put his hat in the ring. Things looked so bleak earlier in the summer, when Ryan came out strong after the Republican convention, that Laska had made it known to Kielty's campaign manager that he would be scaling back his fundraising for the embattled Democratic incumbent. He didn't come right out and say it, but the inference was clear. Ed was a lost cause. This provoked an immediate response from Kielty and his people. The next morning, Laska was on his jet from Santa Barbara with a private dinner invitation to the White House. He was ushered into the People's House quietly. No record of his visit was recorded, and Kielty sat down for a private dinner with a venerable liberal kingmaker. "Paul, things may look bleak right now," the president said between sips of Pinot Noir. "But I have the mother of all trump cards." "Another assassination is in the works?" Kielty knew Laska did not possess a sense of humor, so this was, in fact, a serious question.
"Jesus, Paul!" Kielty shook his head violently. "No, I had nothing to do with... I mean... don't even..."
Kielty paused, sighed, and then let it go.
"The emir is in my custody, and when the time is right, I will pull him out and shut off Jack Ryan's asinine claim that I am weak on terrorism."
Laska's bushy eyebrows rose. "How did you get him?"
"It doesn't matter how I got him. What matters is that I have him."
Paul nodded slowly and thoughtfully.
"What are you going to do with the emir?"
"I just told you. Late in the election, my campaign manager, Benton Thayer, says I should do it at the second or third debate. I'm going to announce to the country that I..."
"No, Ed, I am talking about his trial.
How will you proceed with holding him accountable for his alleged actions?"
"Oh."
Kielty waved an arm in the air as he slid another luscious morsel of prime rib onto his silver fork.
Brannigan, a justice, wants to try him in New York. I'll probably let him do that.
Laska nodded. I think you should do just that, and you should send a message to the world. Kielty cocked his head.
What message?
That America is, once again, the land of justice and peace, no kangaroo courts. Kielty nodded slowly.
You want your foundation to defend him.
It's the only way. Kielty nodded, sipped his wine. He had something that Laska wanted. A high-profile case against the U.S. government.
I can make that happen, Paul. I'll get heat from the right, but who gives a damn? Probably more ambivalence from the left than I would like, but nobody on our side of the aisle will squawk too much about it.
Excellent, Laska said.
Of course, Kielty said. His tone changed a little now that he was no longer sitting in front of Laska with his hat in his hand. You know what a Ryan victory would do to the trial.
Your Progressive Constitution Initiative would have no role in a military tribunal at Gitmo.
I understand.
I can only make this happen if I win. And even with this big reveal I plan at the presidential debate, I will only win with your continued support.
Can I count on you, Paul?
You give my people the Amir case, and you will have my continued backing. Kielty grinned like the Cheshire Cat.
Wonderful.
Paul Laska lay in bed and thought back to that conversation at the White House. Laska's PCI legal team had ironed out all the complicated secret details with the Department of Justice in the intervening months. And now that the news was out about his capture, Laska's people would begin preparing their defense of the Amir the next morning. As Paul listened to the grandfather clock tick in the corner of his dark bedroom, all he could think about was how Ryan would undo it all when he became president of the United States. When, not if, Laska said to himself.
Chovno. Fucking Ed Kielty.
Kielty couldn't even win a debate where he had the best news the country has heard in a year.
Son of a bitch.
Paul Laska decided at that very moment that he would not spend one more goddamn dime on that looser, Ed Kielty. No. He would divert his funds, his power, into one thing. The destruction of John Patrick Ryan, either before he took his inevitable seat in the Oval Office or during his administration. 21. One full day after the Paris operation, all the campus operators, John Clark included, sat in the conference room on the ninth floor of Henley Associates in West Odenton, Maryland. All five men were still tired and sore from the op, but they'd each had a chance to go home and sleep for a few hours before heading into the office for the after-action debriefing. Clark had slept more than the others, but that was only because of the meds. On the aircraft, Adara Sherman had administered painkillers that knocked him out until touchdown, and then he'd been picked up by Jerry Henley and Sam Granger themselves and driven to the private office of a surgeon Henley had retained in Baltimore for just such an eventuality. In the end, Clark hadn't needed surgery, and the doctor was effusive in his praise of the work of the person or persons who'd given the injury its initial cleaning and bandaging. He had no way of knowing the person who had treated the wounded man had worked on more than her share of gunshot wounds in Iraq and Afghanistan, and most of those GSWs were much more serious than the hole left by the 9mm round that pinged off of Clark's ulna. Other than administering an X-ray that revealed a hairline fracture of the bone, then handing over a removable cast, a sling, and a course of antibiotics, Henley's surgeon had little to do other than to remember to keep quiet about the entire matter. Henley and Granger then drove Clark home. Both John's wife, Sandy, a retired nurse, and his daughter, Patsy, a doctor herself, were there waiting for him. They checked his wound over yet again, ignoring his protest that he was fine, and the complaints about the seemingly constant pulling and changing of the medical tape holding his dressing. Finally, John managed to crash a few hours before driving himself back to work for the morning after-action briefing. Jerry started the briefing by entering the room, pulling off his coat, and draping it over the chair at the head of the table. He blew out a long sigh and said,
"Gentlemen, I for one miss the days of poison pens."
The first several wet missions the campus had undertaken, the operators had employed succinylcholine injector pens that were an efficient means for taking a life. A quick turn of the nub of the pen to reveal the syringe tip, then a stroll past the target, and finally a quick jab in the target's ass. The assassin had, in all but a couple of cases, just walked on unnoticed while the target himself continued on down the street, wondering what had just bit or stung him. Until moments later, when the target succumbed to a sudden heart attack and died there, his colleague standing over him with no idea what was wrong, and no idea the man gasping for air had just been murdered before their eyes. It was quick and it was clean, and that was Jerry's point. No one fought back against a heart attack. No one even pulled their guns or their knives because no one realized they were under attack.
"Would that it always worked like that," Jerry said to the room.
Next, each of the operators talked about what they did, what they saw, what they thought about what they did and saw. They went around the room like this for most of the morning, and other than some self-criticisms over small things, the general consensus was that they had all done extremely well to react and respond to the drastic change in the operation at, literally, the last minute. And they also all agreed that they had been damn lucky, John Clark's forearm notwithstanding. Campus head of operations, Sam Granger, had kept quiet through most of the discussion. He had not been on the scene, after all. After the five operators had finished, he stood up and addressed the table.
"We've gone over what happened, but now it's time to talk about fallout. Comebacks. Because even though you guys saved the DCRI officers and took down a known terrorist leader and five of his confederates, that does not mean the FBI won't be fast roping down on Henley Associates if the word gets out that we were involved."
A smile from Dom and Sam Driscoll, the two most go-with-the-flow operators in the unit. The other men were a little more serious about the implications. Granger said,
"I've been monitoring the media reports of the incident, and there is speculation already that this is some sort of terrorist catfight that French security found themselves in the middle of. It is not being reported that DCRI was rescued from assassination by unknown armed individuals. As shitty as it was for you guys at the time that this was such a complicated takedown, it was even more confused from the side of the DCRI. They just saw men crashing into their rooms and shooting at each other. I can't imagine what they were thinking."
Sam motioned to Rick Bell, the chief of analysis at the campus.
"Fortunately, I don't have to. Rick has tasked his analyst downstairs to look into what French authorities know or think they know about what's going on."
Rick stood and addressed the boardroom.
"DCRI and judicial police are both investigating this, but DCRI has not granted interviews of its people on the scene to the police investigators, so the judicial police aren't getting anywhere with their inquiry. DCRI does recognize there were two different sets of actors here, not a single cell that went berserk and shot it out with each other. They haven't gotten much further than that yet, but they are going to dig a lot deeper. That they will continue to investigate is the bad news, but it's nothing that we didn't expect. The good news is, as far as video evidence, you guys seem to be in the clear. There are a couple of distant grainy shots from street cameras. Jack crossing the Avenue Georges Sank on his way around the corner to the Hotel de Serre, and one of John going in the front of the Four Seasons and then coming back out. Also, Ding and Dom turning the corner with the gear under their jackets. But the best facial recog software in the world doesn't have algorithms that can solve for the distortion masks and the sunglasses all you guys are wearing during the ops."
Rick sat back down, and Sam Granger again addressed the room.
"That isn't to say some tourist with a cell phone cam didn't get a close-up shot of one of you. But if that happened so far, it has not come out."
There were a few nods in the room, but no one spoke. Rick said,
"Okay, now let's talk about what you guys helped prevent. According to intercepted communications from French security officials, Al-Qahtani and his men had over 500 rounds of live ammo between them. There were no suppressors on their machine pistols. Those bastards were going to shoot their way in and then shoot their way out. You men saved 6 security officers, but you probably saved another 20 cops and civilians as well."
"What about Roki?" Chavez asked.
"He's gone. 100 sirens on the street saw to that."
Granger said,
"I am of the opinion that Hosni Roki and his men were just MacGuffins. They were not there to commit any sort of terrorist act. They were not there because they were pissed off about the burqa ban. Instead, I think Roki just came to town under orders of Al-Qahtani to draw out French security officers, so that Al-Qahtani and the real terror squad, who were already in place, could ID them and murder them."
"Damn it," said Ryan. "I led us into a buzzsaw by sending John and Ding after Roki in the first place."
Clark said, I'm glad you did what you did. If we weren't on the scene, it would have been bad. Short term, you saved some innocent lives. Long term, hell, those DCRI surveillance operatives might just save the world someday. I'm glad they're still around to do it.
Yeah, Ryan said with a shrug. That made sense. Jerry Henley turned back to Granger.
Conclusion, Sam?
Sam Granger stood.
My conclusion is, you guys did well. But we can't let anything like this happen again. A running gun battle on the streets of a European capital? Cameras, witnesses, police, civilians in the way? This isn't what the campus was set up to do. Jesus, this could have been a debacle.
Jack Ryan Jr. had been riding high for the past 24 hours. Other than Clark's injury, he felt like everything had gone perfectly, except for the fact Roki and his men got away. Even John's busted arm was determined by everyone to be not terribly serious early on. But somehow, Sam Granger had just put it all into perspective, and now Jack wasn't so sure how great he and his team were. Instead, he wondered how much of it could, in fact, be chalked up to luck. They'd raced along a razor's edge on that op, and they hadn't fallen. Luck exists, Jack realized. This time it was good. Next time, it might be bad. The meeting broke for lunch, but Jerry Henley asked Ryan to stay behind for a second. Chavez and Clark remained in the conference room, too. Jack Jr. thought he was about to be taken to the woodshed for arguing with Clark in the middle of the operation about leaving the impending fight and instead heading down to the lobby. He'd been expecting this ever since, and he was sure that if John hadn't been injured and sedated during the flight home, he'd have given Jack a stern talking to on the plane. But instead of a lecture about following orders during an operation, Jerry went in a different direction.
Jack, we are all impressed as hell with you for all the training you've been putting yourself through these past several months. That said, we are a small shop, and with the uptick in op tempo, I can't risk having you miss a day of work right now. I'm going to pull you out of training for a bit.
Jerry, I know that. Jerry held a hand out so that he could stop Ryan's argument, but Chavez jumped in.
Jerry's right. If we were a bigger operation, we could keep men rotating in and out of training all the time. We all respect what you're doing, and I know it's helped you out a lot, but in Paris, you showed that you're absolutely one of the team now, and every one of us needs you out there with us.
Chavez's opinion meant everything to Jack Jr., but still, he felt he needed more experience, and at only 26 years old, he didn't think it possible he could actually be injured during his training. Guys, I appreciate it, I do, I just think... Now Clark spoke up.
You're going to get the rest of your training on the job.
Ryan stopped talking. Instead, he nodded.
Okay.
As the four men left the conference room for their break, Ryan caught up to Clark in the hall.
Hey, John, you got a second?
Sure, what's up?
Mind if we go in your office?
Not if you get us some coffee first.
I'll even stir in your sugar so you don't spill it over your desk doing it one-handed.
5 minutes later, both men sipped coffee in Clark's office. The older man sat with his injured arm out of its sling and propped up on his desk by the elbow of the cast. Ryan said,
John, when you told me to go down to the lobby, I shouldn't have questioned that. I was wrong, and I'm sorry.
Clark nodded.
I've been around the block a few times, Jack. I know what I'm doing.
Of course you do. I just thought...
The older man interrupted.
Thinking is good. It was your thinking that put us in a position to help by sending us after Roki. And your thinking when you saw the van with the suspicious guy sent us to the right location. Your thinking saved a lot of people's lives. I'm never going to tell you to stop thinking. But I will tell you when it is time to shut up and listen to orders. If everybody does what they think is right when the bullets are about to start flying, then we won't operate as a cohesive unit. Sometimes you may not like the order you were given. Sometimes it might not make sense to you. But you have to do as you're told. If you had spent some time in the military, this would be automatic to you. But you haven't. So you're just going to have to trust me.
Ryan just nodded.
You are right. I just let my emotions get in the way. It won't happen again. Clark just nodded, smiled.
What? Jack asked.
You and your dad.
What about my dad?
The similarities. Stories I could tell you.
Go ahead.
But the older man just shook his head.
Need to know, kid. Need to know.
Jack himself smiled now. Somehow, someday, I'm going to get all those stories out of either you or my dad.
Your best chance was on the Gulfstream coming back over the Atlantic. Miss Sherman had me pretty well loopy on pain meds.
Ryan smiled. I missed my chance. Hope I get another chance that doesn't involve you getting shot.
Me too, kid.
Clark shook his head and chuckled.
I've been shot worse than this, but this is the first time I took a round from some cop just trying to do his job. It's hard to get good and mad at anybody but myself.
Clark's phone chirped on his desk. He picked it up.
Yeah? Sure, I'll send him down.
Me too?
Okay, be right there.
Clark looked up at Ryan as he hung up the phone.
Tony Wills needs us at your desk.
22. Jack found Tony Wills sitting in his cube, which was next to Ryan's. With Tony sat Gavin Byerly, the company IT chief. In Ryan's chair, his cousin Dom Caruso sat waiting for him. Sam Driscoll leaned against the partition of the cubicle. Sam Granger and Rick Bell, chief of ops and analysis respectively, were also there and standing around.
Is this a surprise party? Ryan asked.
Dom and Sam both shrugged. They didn't know why Tony had called them down either. But Wills had a pleased grin on his face. He called everyone over to his monitor.
So, it took a while, mostly because the Paris op got in the way, but also because of the quality of the photos, but the facial recog software finally came back with some hits on the guy that Sam and Dom saw meeting with Mustafa El-Dabosi in Cairo the other day.
Cool, said Dom. Who is he?
Gavin, said Wills. You have the con.
Well, Gavin Byerly made his way through the scrum of men in the cubicle and sat down at Will's chair.
The software has narrowed Cairo Man down to two probables.
He worked the keyboard for a moment, and one of the pictures taken by Dom's covert camera in the caravansary in Cairo appeared on one half of the 22-inch monitor. Gavin said,
Facial recog says there is a 93% chance that this guy is...
He clicked his mouse.
This dude.
A picture appeared next to Dom's photo of the man. It was a shot of a Pakistani passport for a man named Khalid Mir. The man wore glasses with round frames and had a trim beard, and he appeared to be several years younger than he looked in the Cairo photo. Immediately, Caruso said,
He's changed a lot, but I think that's the same guy.
Yeah, said Wills.
Well, then your boy is Khalid Mir, a.k.a. Abu Kashmiri, a known operative for Lashkar-e-Taiba over in Pakistan. They are nasty, and Khalid Mir used to be one of their big shots.
Used to be?
Ryan answered before Wills. One of Kilty's drone attacks supposedly took him out in Pakistan about 3 years ago. That was about the same time LET started branching out and sending its operatives against Western targets. Before that, they had been almost exclusively a Kashmir-based terror group who struck India and only India. Dom Caruso spun around and looked at Ryan.
No offense, Junior. But aren't you supposed to know all these guys on site?
Jack shrugged. If this guy was LET fighting against India and he died 3 years ago, he wasn't exactly on my threat matrix for dangerous Western terrorists.
Makes sense. Sorry.
Not at all. Granger looked at Driscoll now.
Sam, you aren't saying anything. Dom thinks this is the guy you saw in Cairo.
Dom answered for his partner.
Sam pegged the guy at the time as a military officer.
Driscoll nodded.
I was sure of it, but this photo does look like it could be the same guy.
Gavin Byerly smiled.
You thought he was a military officer, huh? Well, the recog software says there's a 96% chance you were right.
He made a few more clicks of his mouse. The photo of Khalid Mir's passport disappeared and was replaced by a grainy photo of a man in an olive-green uniform crossing a street, carrying a briefcase and papers under his arm. This man looked older and fuller in the face than the passport photo of Khalid Mir. Driscoll nodded forcefully.
That is the guy from Cairo.
I'll be damned, muttered Sam Granger.
Who is he, Tony?
He is Brigadier General Riaz Rehan.
General of what?
He's in the Pakistani Defense Force. He is also the current director of Joint Intelligence Miscellaneous of the ISI.
A shadowy figure, even though he's a department head and a general. There are no known photos of the man other than this one.
But wait, Clark said. If this is Cairo guy, can Khalid Mir be Cairo guy too?
Could be, said Byerly, but he didn't clarify.
Tony Wills admonished him.
Gavin, we talked about this. No dramatics, please.
Byerly shrugged.
Damn. We IT guys never get to have any fun. Okay, here's the thing. Both of these pictures, the ISI guy and the LET guy,
have been in the database the CIA uses for facial recognition for a long time, but they were never matched with one another.
Why not? Asked Clark.
Gavin seemed glad to be asked this question. Because facial recognition algorithms aren't perfect. They do better when the faces being compared are photographed from the same angle with the same light values. By using facial metrics, that is to say the distance between key landmarks like eyes and ears and such, the software determines a statistical probability that it is looking at the same face. If there are too many anomalies, either because the faces don't match very well, or because the photographs are taken at different resolutions, or one of the pictures is registering some movement of the subject, then the match probability goes down precipitously. We can solve for these external discrepancies somewhat by using something called the active appearance model, which removes the shape of the face and only uses the texture as a comparison.
Dom Caruso said, "Sorry, Gavin, but we have to be back upstairs in 10 minutes. Can you cut to the chase?"
"Dom, let's indulge him for another minute, okay?" asked John.
Dom nodded, and Byrie addressed Clark directly now, as though the other men were not in the room. "Anyway, the picture of Khalid Mir on his passport and the picture of Riaz Rian crossing the street in Peshawar are just too different for current facial recognition software to connect, because there are too many variances in angle, lighting, type of equipment used for the photograph. And, of course, Rian is wearing sunglasses, which is not as much of a problem as it used to be before a newer software design began being used, but it sure doesn't help. So, these two pictures," he drew his cursor back and forth between the two older pictures on the monitor, "do not match."
Then he took the cursor over to the Cairo picture taken 3 days earlier.
"But both of these two pictures do match this picture, because it retains just enough of the characteristics of the other two. It's in the middle, so to speak."
Chavez asked, "So all three shots are definitely the same guy?"
Byrie shrugged. "Definitely? No. We don't like to use that term when discussing mathematical probabilities."
"Okay, what is the probability?"
"It's about a 91% chance Cairo dude, general dude, and dead dude are all the same dude."
All eyebrows in the room raised high. Ryan spoke for the group. "Holy shit."
"Holy shit indeed," said Wills. "We have just learned that a known terrorist for LET is not only not dead, but is now a department chief for Pakistani intelligence."
And Granger said,
"And this department head for the ISI who is or was an LET operative is now meeting with a known bad guy in Cairo."
"I hate to state the obvious," Dominic said, "but we need to learn more about this Rehan guy."
Granger looked at his watch.
"Well, that was the most productive lunch break we've had in a while. Let's head back up to the conference room."
Back upstairs, Granger filled Henley in on the developments. Immediately, the discovery made by Tony Wills and Gavin Byrie superseded the Paris operation as the main focus of the meeting.
"This is big," said Henley, "but it's also all very preliminary. I don't want to jump the gun on this and leak intelligence to CIA or MI6 or anyone else that isn't 100% solid. We need to know more about this general in the ISI.
Everyone agreed. Henley said,
"How can we check this out?"
Ryan spoke first. "Mary Pat Foley. The National Counterterrorism Center knows as much about Lashkar as anyone. If we can find out more about Khalid Mir before he became Riaz Rehan, maybe we can use that to link the two guys together."
Henley nodded.
"We haven't paid a visit on Mary Pat in a while. Jack, why don't you give her a call and take her to lunch? You can run on down to Liberty Crossing and show her the Mir-Rehan connection. I bet she'll find that very interesting."
"I'll give her a call today."
"Okay. Keep our sources and methods under your hat, though."
"Understood."
"And Jack, whatever you do, don't mention that you just got back from Paris."
The conference room erupted in tired laughter. 23. 61-year-old Judith Cochran's rental car came with in-dash GPS, but she did not set it for the 40-mile drive down from Colorado Springs. She knew the way to 5880 State Highway 67, as she had been here many times to visit her clients. Her rented Chrysler pulled off South Robinson Avenue, and she stopped at the first gate of ADX Florence. The guards knew her by sight, but still they looked over her documents and identification carefully before letting her pass. It wasn't easy for an attorney to see a client at Florence. It was harder still for an attorney to see a client housed in H Unit. And a Range 13 client was nigh on impossible to meet with face to face.
Cochrane and the Progressive Constitution Initiative were in the later stages of drafting a lawsuit to address this issue. But for now, she had to play by the rules of Supermax. As one of the most regular visitors to ADX Florence, Judith had come prepared. She would carry a purse with nothing of value in it because she would have to leave.